Okay, in the next 45 minutes, I'm going to review the mental health aspects, studies, as well as some theory behind the relationship between, I'm going to be talking about religion, and I'm going to be using that term pretty broadly. But nevertheless, I am talking about religion. So we're going to review research that looks at the relationship between religious beliefs and practices and mental health. So, religious beliefs, religion is a powerful coping behavior. I think that's something that kind of is a basic part when you're talking about mental health. And that it plays a role in coping. Religion is a powerful coping behavior as people deal with stress. Many persons turn to religion for comfort when they become sick, either physically sick or emotionally sick or distressed. Many have nowhere else to turn, particularly if they may not have a lot of finances, or if the treatments aren't working, or they don't have a lot of family support, and so there aren't too many other options. Religion is used to cope with problems common among those with medical and psychiatric illness, which things such as uncertainty about their illness, its course, what's going to happen next, fear, certainly among psychiatric patients, all of the things to be fearful of in terms of, delusions and hallucinations and all of these things. How scary. Imagine a world that is constantly changing. Imagine the kind of fear that evokes in people. Pain and disability if they become sick, medically ill, loss of control, discouragement and loss of hope. So religion is used to deal with all of those factors. We're going to look at how common religious coping is among medical inpatients, how common is it among different disorders, and look at this case here. So this is a case out of JAMA, an 83-year-old lady with multiple serious medical problems and progressive, unrelenting pain. She's got some serious pain problems. It's a neuropathic kind of a pain, which is not very responsive to narcotic analgesics. She has diabetes with peripheral neuropathy, and she's got spinal stenosis, and it's cutting into her spinal column and causing all sorts of weakness as well as pains in her, and it's progressive, and it's unresponsive to the traditional medical treatments, and she has also tried some of the alternative treatments. She's tried acupuncture and massage and various types of herbal preparations. Nothing seems to work for her pain level. She has limited material resources. She lives alone. She's older. She doesn't have a lot of family around. Doesn't have much education either. So not a whole lot of resources. But despite this, she's positive, hopeful, and optimistic. This is actually a patient of one of the editors of the Journal of the American Medical Association, one of the editors that does the section called Clinical Crossroads. This is a patient of that doctor's. And this doctor, who is a professor of medicine at Harvard, happens to not be very religious until the doctor is a she, encountered this lady. And she couldn't do much for the lady each time the lady came in. But despite the fact that the doctor couldn't do much, the lady was always positive, optimistic, hopeful, and was doing well psychologically. And this was impressive to this doctor, who was, like I said, was not particularly religious to begin with. functioning completely independently without assistance, and she was concerned with meeting other people's needs, in fact. Not uncommonly, the doctor would catch her in the hospital going from room to room. You know, when he had to admit her to treat her diabetes, she'd be going from room to room praying with patients, encouraging other patients in the hospital. So he was trying to get her to stay in her room, and he couldn't do that, but, you know, in any case. How does she do it? He would ask her, you know, how do you do this? How do you manage to stay so positive despite all these problems and this pain? And she says, it's because of my religion, doc. So anyway, so this is out of Jemma. This is her words. I don't dwell on the pain. Some people get sick and have pain and it gets the best of them. Not me. I pray a lot. I believe in God. I give my whole heart, body, and soul over to Him. Sometimes I pray and I'm in deep, serious prayer and all of a sudden my pain gets easy. It slackens up and I drop off to sleep. I wake up and I can do things for myself. So prayer helps me a lot. I give God my heart and soul, and you don't have to worry about nothing. He leads you and directs you. He takes care of you. I believe in that. That is my belief. So that's what this particular patient in this particular tradition, which was the Judeo-Christian tradition, this is how she was coping with her pain. All major world religions address these issues of suffering and pain. So it's not unique to Christianity or Judaism or Islam, the monotheistic traditions. But this is a common way that the people within the monotheistic traditions will cope. And you can see how this might work. When she's in prayer, she has kind of a meditation. She's in deep meditation. She has a relaxation response. I mean, Herb Benson talks about how the people, when they go into a meditative state, they get into a deep kind of, they relax. And so, now she's using the more traditional Judeo-Christian prayer, but I think she might be eliciting this relaxation response as well. So her muscles, instead of being all tight because she's in pain, they relax, and the blood can flow to those muscles again, carry away those pain-causing chemicals that have built up. And so, and she says it, you know, she the pain slackens up and then she can sleep. So now she's able to sleep, and when she wakes up, she's more functional. She can do more for herself. So you can see how even, you know, just physiologically this would work. Praying, relaxation from the prayer, and then, you know, the partial relief of pain. So the person can do more for themselves and is more functional. Now, again, it was, I think, patients like this lady here that drew me into the field. Oops. It was patients like this. These were the kind of patients I was seeing when I was in family practice, taking care of older adults who were rehabilitating after a stroke or surgery. And I ran into several patients like this, and this was 1985, 1986. And that's what got me interested. I thought, gee whiz, I was impressed like this doctor was. Now, there have been a lot of studies looking at this religious coping, mainly in medical conditions, not a whole lot in psychiatric illness. So that's an area, like severe persistent mental illness, that we don't know that much about. We know a lot about religious coping in medical conditions. Arthritis, diabetes, cancer, many studies. There are probably over 70 studies now. They're in the handbook of religion and health. And if you look at the appendix, see, what you can do with this handbook, you ought to have it, if you're at the university, you ought to have at least one copy of it. Because in the appendix of this book, there is, all the studies are listed in the appendix here. See, and it gives where it was done at. It gives the country and the state. So if you look at religious coping, you can turn to religious coping section and you can know exactly where these studies were done. So you know what population, you know, the European studies, and say whether it's in Austria or Switzerland or Germany or England. And it will help you identify where these studies were done. And again, it's not only older adults, but younger adults as well. Adolescents, sickle cell, you know, sickle cell disease in African Americans or black Africans from Africa, the sickle cell, AIDS, etc. Now at Duke Hospital, when you study a random sample of patients and you ask them to what extent they use religion to cope, you give them a little scale from 0 to 10. This is a very simple kind of a study. From 0 to 10, and you say, to what extent do you use religion to cope? What we found is that 40%, circle 10, of this. Now, this is in Durham, North Carolina. Bear in mind, that's a religious area of the country. It's in the South, called the Bible Belt. Although Duke does get patients from all over the country and the world because it's a major referral center. We have people from Arabia and all over the place coming there to get medical care. But still, most of the patients are from the North Carolina area. So that reflects this to some degree. But you can see that 9 out of 10 patients circled 5 or higher on that scale. So 90% were 5 or higher, between 5 and 10. Where 5 meant a moderate extent, and then 7.5 a large extent, and then 10 was the most important factor. So at least among medical patients, in certain areas of the world, religion is used a lot to cope. Now after September 11th, this was in the New England Journal of Medicine, so top medical journal, they asked Americans how they were coping, and 90% of Americans turn to religion as a response to coping with the uncertainty, the anxiety involved in the terrorist attacks. So, God, if you're up there, give me a sign. I'm up here, so. How religion influences coping. Now, there's a lot of ways that religion can influence coping. One is it provides a positive worldview. A positive worldview that becomes particularly important when people are sick. Okay, so as long as you're young and healthy and you're pretty much in control of your life, you really don't need religion. Religion is not all that important. As long as things are going well in your life and all that. But when things start not going so well, that's when your worldview becomes important. And in particular, as I said earlier, the meaning and purpose that people derive from things that happen to them, whether it's physical illness, whether it's emotional illness, whether it's trauma. Religion provides that meaning and purpose. It helps people to psychologically integrate negative experiences. Now, the way this works is sometimes not the way you would expect it to work. You know, you would say, well, okay, well, what about the rigid, fundamentalist belief systems? You know, they couldn't possibly have, you know, a benefit to mental health. And yet, it is interesting when you compare different religious belief systems. There was a study done actually by the president of the American Psychological Association. Seligman is his name. He was a 1998 president of the APA. He did a study comparing different religious groups in terms of their optimism, their level of optimism and positive kinds of emotions. And he had non-believers, now this is in the U.S., he had Jews and Catholics, he had liberal Protestants, moderate Protestants, and then fundamentalist Protestants. And so he was looking at their levels of optimism, and he was just doing the survey using his instrument, and he found, lo and behold, is who has the most optimism of everybody. It's the fundamentalists. Have a higher level of positive emotions and optimism than any other religious group. And so, you know, you think, well, why is that? And if you look at their hymns, you all you got to do is read their hymns, or you read their prayers, or you listen to some of the sermons. They're full of hope and optimism. I mean, there's just everything about being saved and being in eternity and being in paradise, and as long as you play the rules by the game, you know. As long as you're playing the rules, the game by the rules, you're okay. And so, you know, it provides those people with a belief system that seems to make sense. Now, another example would be, there was a small island in the Pacific where a hurricane hit the island, destroyed the village, and a bunch of people got killed. And it was a very religious island, you know. And so there were some relief workers. The mental health professionals came there to take care of, you know, to provide relief and help for the people of the island. And the churches, the ministers were all saying the hurricane was caused by your sinful lifestyles. That was what the preacher was saying. There was too much attention being paid to the pearl industry. They had a big pearl industry on the island. So way too much, not going to church often enough, you know, having basically not living very holy lives. And that's why God sent this hurricane to destroy the village. And so the mental health professionals were really upset about that the ministers were in fact saying that, because they were adding, you know, this idea of guilt on top of the loss and the trauma that these people had experienced from the hurricane. But what they didn't realize was that this was providing, the preachers were providing, all fundamentalist, you know, as these beliefs, rigid as these beliefs would seem, it was providing an explanation. These people's lives were totally out of control. They couldn't predict what was going to happen next. However, the preachers were giving them a religious explanation. Now, it may have been, whether or not it was the correct explanation, doesn't matter. It gave them an explanation to help predict. Okay, well, if I start going to church and start praying more, there won't be another hurricane. So it gave them some control, something they could do to help prevent something like this happening again. Now, of course, by the time the next hurricane hits, people have backslided to their old ways anyway, you know, after probably a couple of months. So it's probably they're ready to, again, have the same explanation, you know, to shape up their lives. So that actually helped the people do better just having that explanation. It's the psychological integration of the negative life experience that returns the person's worldview to some sense of coherence. It's this sense of coherence. A coherent worldview is what is necessary in order to move to the next step of healing after something terrible happens to you. So it provides hope, personal empowerment, a sense of control. You know, if you get sick and you're in the hospital, you can lie in your hospital bed and depend on on the doctors, you know, on the medicines, and just kind of lay there, or you can do something for yourself. You can become active in your own healing. And by praying, it's an activity that anyone can do that gives them a sense of control. It's an indirect source of control. By praying to God, people believe that God can influence their condition. So it gives them this sense of control over the condition, which reduces their anxiety level. Role models for suffering. A good example would be the book of Job. Now, when people get sick or bad things happen, they're always asking why. You know, why me? It's part of the trying to put the worldview back together. They're trying to find an explanation so they have some sense of control over things. So they ask why. Why did this happen to me? Is God punishing me? And for the people on the island, you know, that was the explanation that the ministers were using. You know, but people are always asking why me when they get sick or serious illness. And this is particularly, people become angry at God. They become angry at God. The why me, not only the why me, but as Job was asking why also, but he was angry. He was angry at God for allowing all of this to happen. And many people, particularly whether they have, if they have any religious beliefs, they're going to think about this. They're going to think about, you know, what I did that caused me to deserve, you know, this, as they're trying to put it together. And so the Bible gives these role models so people don't feel guilty for feeling that way. You see, what happens is that people feel angry at God, then they feel guilty for feeling angry at God. But the book of Job gives you an example of, here's a guy in the Bible, a whole book written about this guy who was angry at God, had bad stuff happen to him, and God could handle it. You know, it normalizes some of the normal feelings and reactions that people have after bad things happen to them. Guidance for decision making. You know, when again bad things happen, people deal with it in different ways. If they have a surge of emotion and it becomes intolerable, they may turn to alcohol, turn to drugs, turn to all sorts of different coping behaviors to reduce the stress level. Religion provides guidance or rules for behavior which helps to reduce the negative responses to stress. It provides answers to ultimate questions. I mean, again, if things are going well in your life, the idea of where you came from, what you're doing here, and where you're going doesn't really matter all that much because you're kind of focused on the day-to-day activities. But when things aren't going well in your life, when you're depressed, when you're sick, when you've had terrible things happen to you in your life, when you're getting older and you're getting disabled, those questions, those ultimate questions become much closer to the surface. You can't deny them as easily as when you're young and healthy. Again, we can easily deny we're going to ever die. You know, when you're young and healthy, you just push it out of your mind. You don't focus on it. But when you get sicker and you get older and you get more disabled and you get into hospital and you're getting chemotherapy, it's getting closer and closer. It's harder to say, well, you know, I'm never going to die. I don't have to think about this. You know, where am I going? Why am I here? That's when people start thinking about these things. And we have no answer to that. What can scientists say? Yes.
I just wanted to ask if there are any studies that look at how religion may have a negative impact in terms of in terms of being many different elements of religious practice and the formation, are there any aspects that have been identified as being negative?
Not as much. Not as much. There hasn't been as much research looking at the negative aspects. We've done some on negative religious coping. And so Ken Pargament and myself, we have a scale, a negative religious coping scale, where it assesses the degree to which patients feel punished, you know, the negative feeling that it's caused by the devil, the illness, whatever. So we have that scale. That does predict a whole lot of things. It's only 7 items, actually. It's a very powerful predictor of all sorts of negative health outcomes. But religion is very powerful. It can be used for good or for evil. There's no doubt about that. I mean, there's nothing that is only good in this life, that is only purely, absolutely good. I mean, chemotherapy doesn't always have good effects on people. There's no drugs, antipsychotic drugs and antidepressant drugs, you know, but the positives seem to outweigh the negatives. So it's more about the ratio of risk to benefit. And it seems as though religion has, while it has plenty of risks, it has also plenty of benefits. So it's a matter of kind of balancing and seeing how the overall balance turns out. And then social support. In America, the largest source of social support that older adults in America have is from their religious organizations, by far. There's no other form of support within society that provides more support for older adults than does religious communities. And this is based on large studies of populations where people are asked about their closest friends and to what extent their closest friends come from their religious community. And again, it's not lost with physical illness or disability. So many ways that people cope, when you get sick, you lose it. I mean, if you cope by being social and you're interacting with people, you get sick and disabled. You can't go out and socialize anymore. If you cope by going golfing or by your exercise or your, when you get sick, you can't do that anymore. So, you know, as you get older too, you know, your kids start getting involved in their own life. And if you think you're going to be able to depend on your children, you know, I wouldn't put too much stock in that. You know, so this is not lost as people move into these areas where other coping resources fall away. Now, this is just some of the research, mainly our studies from Duke. This is looking at well-being levels. This was one of the first studies that I actually did. This is 20 years old. This was in the Midwest. This is about 800 or so, 850 older adults, over 60. And we used a standard well-being scale called the Philadelphia Geriatric Center Morale Scale, which is 17 items. It ranges in score from 1 to 4 for each item. So it has a nice range of responses. It's focused mainly on geriatrics, though, on older adults. So we measured level of well-being. We looked at religious attendance and level of intrinsic religiosity, and we found this relationship with the lowest well-being in people who were older adults not attending religious services or having low religiousness, and the highest well-being among those actively involved in these religious practices. This is a study at Duke Hospital, not at Duke Hospital, go ahead.
Does intrinsic religiosity and church attendance correlate so strongly?
Church attendance and intrinsic religiosity do correlate, but they don't correlate as strongly as with private religious activities and intrinsic religiousness. So there's a stronger correlation between personal private religious activities like prayer and scripture reading and meditation and intrinsic religiousness than with church attendance. But they do correlate. They do correlate.
Probably it depends on what the religious background.
Yes, it does. It would depend on the religious background how closely correlated church attendance or religious attendance is to intrinsic religiousness, I would guess. I'm not sure if anybody has actually shown that or studied that yet. But in studies we've done, which is mainly a Protestant population, you definitely see a stronger relationship with the personal religious activities. Again, because many reasons people go to religious services, some of which are not religious. So that dilutes the correlation. Now, this is a sample of 1,000 consecutively admitted men to the VA hospital. So these are all men, there are about two-thirds of the sample are older men, about a third of the sample are younger men. We used the geriatric depression scale and used the usual cutoff, I think 16 on the geriatric, or 11 on the geriatric depression scale, 30-item scale. And we looked at the percentage depressed based on to what extent they were using religion to cope. Now, these are not psychiatric patients, bear in mind. These are all medical patients. This is general medicine and neurology. So that's the population. These are consecutive admissions. So it's a consecutive sample. With higher religious coping, lower rates of depression. This is a study at Duke Hospital. These are all depressed patients, but not psychiatric patients. These are all medical patients, again, on cardiology, neurology, and general medicine. But they're diagnosed with a depressive disorder using a structured psychiatric interview, the diagnostic interview schedule. So they're diagnosed with depression and they're followed for 1 year with symptoms being assessed every couple of weeks. And what we find is that this is a Kaplan-Meier survival curve. In other words, you start out with everybody depressed, and this is the probability of non-remission. So the probability of non-remission at time zero is 100%, because everyone is depressed at time zero. That's the criterion for admission into the study. So you can see if you divide them into level of intrinsic religiousness, they begin to separate out, such that those with the highest intrinsic religiosity are recovering faster from depression at pretty much every time point. That is statistically significant and independent of other risk factors for remission in this population. This is the first study looking at the outcome of a major psychiatric disorder that was published. To my knowledge, it was the first. Adrian Brahm's study was close about that year, in fact, 1 year earlier, but he didn't look at psychiatric disorders. They looked at psychiatric symptoms using a symptom scale. They didn't look at actual disorders. This is the first one looking at outcome of a psychiatric disorder. And there were a lot of letters to the editor, actually, after this came out in the American Journal of Psychiatry. One was from Columbia University, actually very positive letters. It kind of surprised me. I was thinking, you know, this is a psychiatry journal. You would think negative letters to the editors criticizing the methods or something. You know, but there weren't any negative letters. It was the chairman of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins wrote in about a study of caregivers of Alzheimer's patients and end-stage cancer patients. And what they had found was that the caregivers of the end-stage cancer or Alzheimer's patients, there were two factors predicting adaptation to the caregiver role in their study in Baltimore. And it was social support and level of religiousness. And those were the only factors that predicted the speed at which the caregivers were adapting to the caregiver role. And there was a study out of Columbia University in New York looking at women with depression and the transmission of their depression to their children. And that seemed to be affected by the level of religious involvement of the mothers, seemed to affect the likelihood of transmitting the depression to the children. Lisa Miller has done a lot of work in that particular area with regard to children and depression in particular. Now, this is just looking at the suicide rates in the U.S. and comparing them to large groups. These are white males. You can see that this kind of looks at the church attendance versus the suicide. You can see here, this is the suicide rate on this axis here per 100,000. This is the mean church attendance. I think it's, I don't know, I think it might be for a month. Church attendance, number of times per month attending. And so here's your church attendance. You see white males have the lowest church attendance, highest suicide rate. And among elderly white males, they have fairly low, particularly those who are not married or divorced or separated or using substance abuse, of course, their suicide rate is above 100 per 100,000, about 110 per 100,000. Very low church attendance rates in that particular group. And then as you go to black males, church attendance goes up, suicide rate drops. White females, church attendance goes up further, suicide drops further. Black females, suicide rate is low, church attendance is very high. And among elderly black women, church attendance is somewhere up there along the rafters, believe it or not. And suicide rates in that group are undetectable. They can't even detect them based on the national census. They're less than 1 per 100,000. So there does seem to be a relationship with regard to suicide. This relationship has been replicated almost 100 times now. In all different countries in Europe, it's been shown that even the European countries that produce more religious books have lower suicide rates. So if you just look at religious book production, there's a clear relationship with suicide. So, anyway. This is looking at anxiety disorders. This is a random sample of 3,000 people. This is part of the ECA studies. This is the Epidemiologic Catchment Area Surveys in the 1980s. Large random studies. This is the first study of rates of psychiatric disorder in the United States population. The first time there had been a major epidemiological study, because they used the DSM criteria for the first time to be able to, I think it was DSM-3 criteria, to actually get psychiatric disorder rates. And in the Duke site, there were five sites. One was in Durham. They included a church attendance item in there. And then later on, I looked at the relationship, And at all age groups, the anxiety disorder levels are lower among those who are attending services more often. Now, part of this, you know, is confounded by the fact that, you know, this includes disorders like panic disorder and possibly agoraphobia. You know, so that people are less likely to go to church. You're not absolutely, this is a cross-sectional correlation, so we're not absolutely sure whether it's the religion, you know, the church attendance lowering the anxiety level, or whether it's the high anxiety lowering the church attendance level. So with these cross-sectional studies, it's just difficult to sort that out. So anyway, are you plagued by doubt? Do you question the existence of God? Is your faith challenged by the vicissitudes of modern life? Do you think the church is full of phonies and hypocrites? You may suffer from, and here's a new DSM-4 disorder, a general spiritual anxiety disorder. And the new treatment is called Prozac. The exciting new over-the-counter pharmaceutical 9 out of 10 ministers recommend. So, Prozac. Now, for those of you interested in PTSD, this is a study that just came out. This was 1,400 veterans of Vietnam, World War II, and Korea. This was done by the VA National Center for PTSD and Yale University. They were able to show that a weakened religious faith as a result of the traumatic experience, which was kind of a loss of faith, was a predictor of use of mental health services. And in fact, it was a more powerful predictor of use of mental health services than was the severity of the PTSD. So when they measured the severity of the PTSD itself, it predicted use of mental health services less well than did one question on loss of religious faith as a result of the trauma. So they kind of concluded that the use of mental health services was driven more by a weakened faith than by clinical symptoms or by social factors, and that these people had been going to VA for chronic mental health care for years and years, for decades, and no one had addressed that spiritual injury or that loss of religious faith. And that was why they were needing the PTSD service. That may have been a factor in their need for the services, that their psychological issues were being addressed, but their spiritual injury was basically being ignored. There have been a couple of randomized clinical trials. There is a study of mindfulness meditation for GAD in Buddhists that shows that mindfulness meditation is correlated in a, not just correlated, but in a clinical trial. Kabat-Zinn from Massachusetts shows that there is clearly a lowering in anxiety levels among those practicing mindfulness meditation. Also, for generalized anxiety disorder, there have been two clinical trials, actually three now, in Muslims from Malaysia, showing that repeating the verses from the Quran and saying the prayers four times a day is related to lower anxiety levels among those with clinical anxiety disorders. And also those using a Tao-based approach to cognitive therapy seems to lower rates of anxiety disorder as well. And there have been studies in Christian populations as well, but mainly longitudinal studies or prospective studies that in panic disorder, in treatment studies, those who have a higher importance of religion seem to get better faster over time with treatment, with psychiatric treatment and the religiousness. So substance abuse, again, it's hard to know what's causing what here, but at least there are fewer alcoholics in church. You know, if there's nothing else, you can absolutely conclude that there are fewer alcoholics in church. Whether it's that fact that the alcohol prevented them from going to church, or the church prevented, you know, the alcohol is, we don't know that yet, but in any case. Now, this is an interesting study of patients at Johns Hopkins. Actually, they're not patients. These are medical students. These are all doctors, graduates from the medical school at Johns Hopkins. A large sample, 1,400 students entering between 1948 and 1967. And then they were followed up in 1986 looking at predictors of alcohol abuse. And this was published in the American Journal of Medicine. And what they found was that these are the predictors, 30 years later, of which of the doctors ended up with substance abuse problems. If they smoked at least a pack of cigarettes a day in medical school, they were 2.6 times more likely to have an alcohol problem 30 years later. If they had a past history of alcohol problems in medical school, understandably, they were more likely to have problems currently. If they were not Jewish, they were at greater risk. So being Jewish reduces the likelihood of alcohol abuse. It may be the same thing that's happening with Chinese. I think rates of alcohol abuse are fairly high. Has to do with, you know, that enzyme in the liver. The alcohol dehydrogenase may vary. There may be a variant of the enzyme in different population groups, including Jewish people. But, you know, basically, if you don't have that enzyme and you drink, you don't feel all that good, or at least the hangover is a lot worse. You may feel good for a while, but, you know, that dehydrogenase can't metabolize the alcohol. Regular use of alcohol in medical school, but the strongest predictor of all predictors, more than smoking, more than history of alcohol use, was lacking a religious affiliation. They were 4 times more likely, independent of these other factors. This is looking at cigarette smoking. I believe you guys in Hungary, also found a correlation between cigarette smoking rates and religious involvement.
Yeah. There is a huge study that every 5 years, it's more than 12,000 people surveyed, and they did cigarette smoke, they did coping intensity, depression, anxiety, alcohol abuse.
And days lost from work also, right?
Days lost from work.
Yeah.
Significant benefits for those who are more
religious
than less.
Yeah, yeah. This is a summary of the research. I'm running out of time here for this session, but these are studies that show the numerator, you know, the thing on top, the numerator. That is the number of studies showing a statistically significant correlation between religiousness and better mental health in each of these domains. The numerator, the denominator, which is the bottom number, is the total number of studies done. So since the 1800s. So in studies in the psychiatric literature, basically out of PsychLit, if you look at PsychLit and you look at Midline, and what you find of the 114 studies that have been done, 91 show that the religious person has more positive emotions, more well-being, more hope, more optimism. If you look at purpose and meaning in life, 15 of those 16 studies show a relationship. Social support, virtually all of the studies. And bear in mind, these are not studies done by departments of religion. These are psychology departments, sociology, public health, nursing, medicine, generally secular departments, which historically have been hostile towards religion because of the science-religion kind of antagonism. So coming out of these secular departments is a huge volume of research documenting significant positive associations between religion and virtually every mental health outcome you can think of. If you look at the total number of quantitative studies, nearly 500 of those 724 studies show a statistically significant relationship. And again, they're all listed in the appendix of the handbook, if you want to look. Now, since the year 2000, that was all prior to the year 2000, there were those studies. Since the year 2000, there has been a flood of studies looking at this in the secular psychology, sociology literature. This just gives you a sense of how much attention this field is getting. These are entire issues of these secular journals devoted to religion, spirituality, and mental health. That means the entire issue, all of the articles in the particular issue are devoted to that topic. And you can see some of the mainstream journals. The top psychology journal, The American Psychologist, had an entire issue devoted to that. Journal of Health Psychology, Psychiatric Annals, which we get that in the United States, was devoted to it. The Southern Medical Journal, in last December, the entire issue of the Southern Medical Journal was on religion, spirituality, and medicine. So this is a mainstream medical journal, goes out to 16,000 doctors in the southern United States. The entire issue, every 3 months, they are having a partial issue in the Southern Medical Journal devoted to religion, spirituality, and medicine. It's an entire program, CME program, that they are developing for medical students. Now, if you look at the volume of research, and I encourage you to do this, you can do this, in fact, here, if you've got a university library, and you've got Cyclic. And all you have to do is you put in the words religion and spirituality. You put those in the search in Cyclic, and you go from the 1800s up to currently. And what you'll find is that if you restrict your years to 1980 to 1982, and you just look at the studies or the articles on religion and mental health during that two-year period, you'll find 101 articles. You'll find no articles on spirituality, because this term was not in existence in the scientific literature until the early 1990s. So in 1980, there were no articles on it. However, if you look now in the last 2 years, actually, this is a three-year period, there were 101 articles. If you look at this period, which is 2.5 years, I did this in, I think, May. You find that there were almost 1,800 articles in just the last 2.5 years. If you look at the time since the year 2000, since, not counting any of these studies, let's just completely eliminate all of those studies. Don't even count those studies, those 800 studies. You'll find that there are almost 3,000 articles just since the year 2000 in the literature. It has increased so much that back in 1980, if you looked at social support, studies looking at social support and mental health, if you looked at the total number of studies, there were 406 on social support and mental health, and you compared it to this, you know, you look at the number of religion, spirituality, says 101, divided by 406, you came up with 25%. Now, in the last 2.5 years, it's almost equal. I mean, there were 1,865 studies, social support and mental health, and there are 1,800 studies on religion, spirituality, and mental health. So it's almost become as mainstream as studying social support. And in particular, one of the reasons why we think this is not just a blip, you know, a fad, is because if you look at the dissertations that people getting their PhDs in now, young investigators getting PhDs in nursing, in psychology, in sociology, in public health, you're seeing a lot of those people doing their PhD dissertations on religion, spirituality, and mental health. So what you're going to see is a new group of PhDs who are going to be likely researchers and teachers who are coming into the field, who are going to start, you know, being the teachers of those in clinical practice in terms of addressing spiritual issues. So I think this is actually a more sustained phenomena than just a fad. So, in summary, religion can have negative effects on mental health and social functioning. I didn't talk a whole lot about those negative effects, but certainly they can, and I'm sure you all are aware of that. You can think of all of the different things, that in certain circumstances, religion can you know, be used to justify non-compliance, and it can be used to, you know, as defensive against changing. It can be used neurotically. All of that is true. However, religion, in general, in epidemiological studies, seems to be correlated with better mental health. And it's at least in the studies in the States, there's so much research out there now that it's hard to argue against that. Even Richard Sloan, even the critics, don't argue the relationship with mental health. Because the research, there's just too much of it. And it makes too much sense. It makes too much logical sense why religion, given its role in coping, ought to be related in general. If you have a reasonably healthy religious worldview, to better mental health. There are psychological and social mechanisms to explain how religion affects coping. Religious involvement is associated with greater well-being, less emotional disorder, and less substance abuse in general. And the field is growing rapidly.